Thank you for listening to the audio podcast of the King's Crossing Church of Christ. To learn more or subscribe, please visit our website at kingscrossingcoc.com. There was an award-winning book published in 1985 by the title Sarah Plain and Tall. Did any of you read that book along the way? It was a very popular book when I was younger. It's a fictional story. It's a historical fiction about a prairie farmer named Jacob, and he has two children named Anna and Caleb. And unfortunately, Jacob lost his wife when she was giving birth to their second child, and so he's been working on all the duties of running a farm and then also trying to raise two children by himself. And the loneliness, the hard work, the exhaustion was getting to be just a bit too much for him. So he decides to take out an advertisement in a newspaper looking for a sort of mail order type bride, where he's seeking a wife. He's seeking companionship, and being so isolated in the farm, he's not really sure anyone would even show any interest. But then he starts receiving correspondence from this woman named Sarah. Sarah lives up in Maine. As she writes them letters, she talks about her love for the sea. She loves living close to the ocean and the beauty up in the Northeast, but just the same, she's curious. And so they begin corresponding, and she writes letters back and forth to the children. They have questions about her. Do you like to smile? Do you like to braid hair? These kinds of things. And so eventually they decide she's at least going to take a trip over to meet the family and to stay with them for a while to see if this might become something greater than just a correspondence. And so as she prepares for the trip, she sends one last letter. So just think about getting ready to meet the person who could be your next spouse, your new parent figure. This is the letter that says, "Dear Jacob, I will come by train. I will wear a yellow bonnet. I am plain and tall. Signed, Sarah." You'd have some more questions, wouldn't you? What exactly should I be expecting when she gets here? Sure, I can look for the yellow bonnet, but there's got to be so much more to her and all the things we're going to find out. I wonder if you've ever been in a situation, even a simple meeting, where you had to meet someone. Maybe it was a business deal that you were supposed to work on, some other reason you had to meet with a specific person you'd never seen before. There is always that awkwardness of, how am I going to know the person when I see them? And when I see them, what are they going to be like? Are they going to be tall and plain? Are they going to be short and feisty? I don't know. What is this person going to be like when I encounter them? And I think that's certainly true of seeking a family member as Jacob was, but this was also a question weighing on the minds of the Israelites for centuries. When the Messiah shows up, what should we be expecting? What is the Messiah going to be like? How can we know him when we see him? How will we recognize him? The context where Jesus arrives is a time of political unrest, and isn't that always the case in human history anyways? But there's great political unrest, and for the Jews, in their perspective, the Jews are a very humiliated people. And this is not only a recent problem, but in fact, you could trace it all the way back to their time of slavery in Egypt. Even after they had some time as a prominent kingdom with their promised land before it, you know, split apart and eventually both halves were conquered, over and over again, for hundreds of years, the Jews have been dominated, taken into captivity, ruled by pagans as they saw it, people who they had great differences with in terms of what they thought about the world and the way things ought to be done. But they were conquered first by the Assyrians and then later conquered by the Babylonians, and then they were conquered by the Greeks, and presently they've been conquered by the Romans. So time and time again, they continue to get passed around from empire to empire without the strength really to fend for themselves. Now, if you were to ask any of these reigning empire figures, what was it that would bring peace to the world? They would give you an answer that I suspect would be similar to what many people in our world would answer. They say, well, wherever you want to have peace, you've got to have power and you've got to have military technology. Certainly some kind of technology, but most of these nations, one would conquer the next based on improving weapons and improved ability to fight and to win. And they would tell you probably that peace comes from power and strength, but ultimately from the dominion of one group over another, where the ruling group's way of living was imposed on everyone else, or certainly expected of everyone else. Now, they valued their politics, but the Romans took this a step further, because when they talked about Caesar, the person ruling over them, they said Caesar was actually a god. They spoke of Caesar as if he were divine, something more than just a mortal person. And so as the Jews are wondering, what will this Messiah be like, they couldn't help but borrow some ideas from the people who had been conquering them for so long. Well, when the Messiah comes, maybe the way that we'll know him is that finally it's our turn to take over. Maybe he'll be a good military leader. He'll have some kind of powers that help him to lead an army, something to help us drive off the Romans, something to help us get our promised land back and get the kingdom back and all the stuff we used to have. It's going to be like the glory days all over again. But they're really thinking in categories very similar to the very peoples who had dominated them and conquered them. So when finally John the Baptist shows up, preparing the way for the Messiah, very imminently so, he shows up just prior to Jesus's arrival, and the way that he introduces the real Messiah must have been quite unlike what they were expecting. John chapter 1 in verse 29 reads, "The next day he saw Jesus coming toward him and said, 'Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. This is he of whom I said, after me comes a man who ranks before me because he was before me. I myself did not know him, but for this purpose I came baptizing with water that he might be revealed to Israel. And John bore witness, I saw the Spirit descend from heaven like a dove, and it remained on him. I myself did not know him, but he who sent me to baptize with water said to me, he on whom you see the Spirit descend and remain, this is he who baptizes with the Holy Spirit. And I have seen and have borne witness that this is the Son of God.'" Very interesting echo in these statements from John. When you reflect back on that story of Abraham and his son Isaac, you remember the story where God had told him to sacrifice his son, and at the last minute, God provided a substitute. How interesting that as the Messiah is coming into the world, the thing that John the Baptist says is, "Behold the Lamb. God has sent us a sacrifice. God has sent us an alternative to all these things that we were anticipating." So God did send someone who would rule the world, but Jesus wasn't going to accomplish this by the typical means people use to conquer. The only blood Jesus ever spilt was his own, and in doing so, conquered the world through this great reversal where the one who had all power chose to lay it all aside and to humble himself and to come to us meekly as this infant, as a teacher, as a friend. He came to us gently, not with weapons of warfare, and instead with love and with self-sacrifice. If you had an opportunity over the last week to tune in, we released a couple of podcast episodes, and for those of you who are visiting with us or haven't been here in a few weeks, what we're doing with this study of John that we've begun is that each week I'm making some specific podcasts available where I've talked to some different scholars with very different viewpoints about the value of John's gospel, and also providing sort of an audio commentary each week on the chapter that we're looking at. So if you had a chance to listen this week, I talked to Keith Stanglin, and he said some really interesting things about John chapter 1, and specifically about John the Baptist. You know, it had never really occurred to me, and I had never been aware that John was as prominent as he was. John the Baptist. Think about Paul's missionary journey, and how even as he traveled hundreds of miles away from where John had ever ministered, there were pockets of followers of John the Baptist. He was a person of enormous prominence, who came to prepare the way for Jesus. He had great recognition. People knew of him. They were interested in him. They were captivated by him. But as John went about his ministry, he wasn't self-seeking. He understood that the reason he was here was specifically to prepare the way for Jesus. You might could say that if you were to encapsulate John's ministry in one statement, you could say that he was someone who was seeking a function in his life, not just a title for his life. That in itself is quite a reversal from the way that most people operate, isn't it? I mean, you spend years working on your education so you can have certain letters after your name or before your name or certain ways that people have to address you. It's gratifying to get a title, to work hard in your company and achieve a new position where they have to address you in a certain way because of what it is that you've achieved, what it is that you've done to get that title, that way that people have to see you and recognize you. Certainly, John's fame would have afforded him a lot of different ways of referring to himself, but John was always much more interested in the function of his life, not the title he could win, but what is the real purpose for why I'm here? I'm going to live into that, not just into whatever attention I can get for myself. John saw the function of his life being to point people toward Jesus. I want to read through this passage in John chapter 1, beginning in verse 19, and I want you to notice this. While all the Jewish leaders are trying to figure out this issue of what title we give you, John is only interested in the function of pointing people toward Jesus. That's the much greater goal for him. It says, "And this is the testimony of John, when the Jews sent priests and Levites from Jerusalem to ask him, 'Who are you?'" That says something about his prominence, doesn't it? For someone to have to come up and say, "Exactly, who are you?" "He confessed and did not deny, but confessed, 'I am not the Christ.' And they asked him, 'What then? Are you Elijah?' He said, 'I am not.' 'Are you the prophet?' And he answered, 'No.' So they said to him, 'Who are you? We need to give an answer to those who sent us. What do you say about yourself?' He said, 'I am the voice of one crying out in the wilderness, 'Make straight the way of the Lord,' as the prophet Isaiah said." Now they had been sent from the Pharisees. They asked him, "Then why are you baptizing if you are neither the Christ, nor Elijah, nor the prophet?" John answered them, "I baptize with water, but among you stands one you do not know, even he who comes after me, the strap of whose sandals I am not worthy to untie." So they say, "Who are you? What should we refer to you as? What's your title? What's your achievement?" He says, "I'm just a guy who's here to point you toward the person you really should be paying attention to." And in the moment, he says, you don't know him. You're not figuring out who it is that's now arrived, this person you've been waiting for. But my purpose is to point to him. I've been given so many good things from God, but the purpose of my life is to point people toward Jesus. And so thinking about what John did in his life, I wanted to reflect on some of the core parts of John's message as we talk about our own lives. Because aren't there some good parallels between what we ought to be doing and what John chose to do? John mirrors that mentality of Jesus. Jesus didn't consider equality with God something to be grasped. He humbled himself. John wasn't interested in fame and fortune. He chose to live a very meager existence out in the wilderness, just preaching to whoever would show up. But John didn't choose to grasp at greatness or fame for himself. He chose to focus on pointing people toward Jesus. So if we're wanting to kind of live into John's way of doing things, something that's very important is that we need to try and make God's path into our lives a very easy one. The way he says it is, make straight the way of the Lord. Now, I have to say, perhaps uniquely so, living in Corpus Christi, we can greatly appreciate the value of a straight and smooth road as opposed to one full of bumps and potholes that you have to swerve in, right? Some of you know what I'm talking about. We can appreciate the value of that, making straight the way of the Lord. So in your life, for God to be able to be at work in your heart, shaping your mind, impacting your actions, you want to make sure that there is a clear path from you to God and that you have done everything you can to make that path very smooth and accessible and easy for God to travel into your heart. I wonder what that might look like, because you can apply that to just about every category of your life, can you not? The way that you spend your time, Are you spending time in the Word? Are you spending time building on the relationships you know to be important? Are you spending time with your prayers, making yourself available to God? And as you pray, asking for God's help, but then also asking for God's wisdom, helping you to see the things that God sees, to care about the things that God cares about. Are we consistent with that in our actions? You know, some people say with every action, you vote for the kind of person you want to be. With every action, you vote for the kind of person you want to be. What are the kinds of things you're doing, and what does that say about you and what you care about? Well, there's that great question. How can I make God's path into my life as easy for God as possible? That I'm available, that I'm interested, and that I'm committed. I came across a story about a man named Laszlo Polgár. And around 1965, Laszlo is wanting to find a wife. And so he reaches out to a woman named Clara and starts courting her, and they're dating. But even before they're married, he says, you know, I've got this idea about the way that genius works. He says, I don't think that genius is born. I think that genius is educated and trained. And he said, you know, I want to have children, but when I have children, I want to experiment and see if I can completely surround my kids with this one thing of importance and make it above all other things their focus, to see if that will produce like a genius level of achievement. And his wife, Clara, agreed, not, I guess she agreed first to marry him, but they married, and then they started having children. They had three daughters named Susan, Sophia, and Judith. And they did several things that were very interesting. They, for one, decided to homeschool their children, which at the time in Hungary was practically unheard of. It was very rare to do that. But they decided that of all the things their kids could become experts on, he said, you know, the game of chess is kind of a respected thing, and it takes some mental fortitude to be good at. And so he just decided that that was going to be the thing their family was just really into. And so all around their house, there were books about chess. There were pictures of chess champions. They would watch anything they could find related to chess. From the moment their kids were old enough to start moving the pieces, they started playing chess with them, and soon thereafter entering them in tournaments. As a family, they would work on anyone that they were ever going to play in a tournament or had played in a tournament. They would keep detailed records about that person, their techniques, their strategies. They would study it. If you look this guy up on Amazon, there are several vast books about chess and strategies for chess that he has investigated. And so the way that this affected their children was that, starting with their oldest daughter, Susan, she began playing when she was 4 years old, and in 6 months, she was easily defeating adults. The middle daughter, Sophia, was even better. By the time she was 14 years old, she was a chess world champion, and in just a few years, she earned the rank of Grand Master. And the youngest daughter, Judith, was the best of all. By age 5, she could handily beat her father. At age 12, she was the youngest player ever in the top 100 in the world. And at 15 years, 4 months old, she became the youngest grandmaster of all time. And she went on to remain the number one female chess player in the world for 27 years. So you could say, you could argue that his experiment was a fairly successful one, that he surrounded them with it. And what was so interesting is when people have interviewed the girls after the fact, you'd wonder, what kind of a miserable existence must that have been growing up in a house like that? But what's so interesting is when they talk about their growing up years, they actually speak of it fondly. Loving chess was just the thing we did. That was just what we were expected to do, and we lived into it. So we surrounded ourselves with it and actually most of the time enjoyed it. In fact, they even share stories about one time, you know, in the middle of the night, parent sees there's like a light on down the halls. They kind of go stumbling and check inside the bathroom door, and one of their daughters was up in the middle of the night playing chess by herself in the bathroom. It's like, you have to leave the pieces alone. And she says, no, but they won't leave me alone. Like, she's just obsessed with it. But thinking about the way that they surrounded themselves with that and the kind of effect that that had on them, I was reminded of this passage in Deuteronomy chapter 6 where God is actually talking about, how is it that you remain my people? How is it that you grow in your faith? He says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might, And these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. So think about this. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. That must be some semblance of what it looks like to make straight the way of the Lord, to give God a clear path into your life, to immerse yourself so completely with the things of God that you can't help but think about it and focus on it and be interested in it. So it's important that we make God's path into our life an easy one. It's also important that we deliberately choose to walk with Christ in order to know Christ. At the end of John chapter 1, John details for us the calling of the first few disciples. And to someone in the ancient world, this would be an interesting detail, because most commonly, if a rabbi or great philosopher teacher was going to have students, the students would seek out the teacher and say, "I want you to be my teacher." But Jesus reverses that, in that he would actively seek people out and say, "You know, I would like for you to follow me, to walk with me, to be my follower." Think about how little some of these initial followers must have known as they started following him. John the Baptist kind of points Andrew toward Jesus. Andrew goes and gets his brother Peter. Their first question to Jesus is simply, "Hey, where are you staying right now?" They don't know anything about this guy, so they follow him just to take an interest in him. Jesus sought out Philip and said to Philip, "Follow me." Philip goes to his brother Nathanael, who's sitting under a fig tree, and this is a situation where Jesus meets Nathanael and says, "Well, yeah, this is a pure Israelite. There's no guile in this person. He's the real deal. And I saw you sitting under the fig tree." And that just blows Nathanael's mind. "You knew I was under the fig tree when we had that conversation?" And Jesus says, basically, "You ain't seen nothing yet. You're amazed at that. Oh, there's a lot more. There's a lot more that we're going to see and experience together." But if we're serious about knowing someone, the best way to really know someone is to journey with that person. We want to think about journeying with Jesus and how we do that in our life, and we try to include God in all aspects of what we do. There's another component of that that's important for us to think about as a church, that we're not on this journey in an isolated fashion, but really we're all in this journey together, that we need to work together on things. I'm always reminded of this when we do things, for example, like mission trips. You know, you get to know someone in an entirely different fashion when you spend several days together in a foreign country and all the weirdness comes out, right? You can't hide it forever. We're all weird in our own ways. Same thing's true of Bible camp, isn't it? You have a week with people, and in some ways you get on each other's nerves, but then you come to love each other more than you possibly could have otherwise because of that time you spent. And the same thing is true for all of us. When we take on new goals, new efforts, when we work hard in ministry together and we bump our heads against the wall and we have to improvise and find new ways and we keep striving, there's something about that shared journey that unites us and helps us to be more than we ever could have been on our own. But in all these things that we're doing and trying to be united with God, united in purpose, we remind ourselves that when we look at the shape of John's life, the purpose of our lives is to point people toward Jesus, to be like a sign that points people toward Jesus. That constant message of come and see. The big dilemma for us these days is not where to find information, right? Any of you, within a couple of seconds, can pull out your phone and you can Google absolutely anything you want to know. There is a limitless amount of information available. And so for many of us, the struggle, certainly for younger children as they're growing up, it's not how do I find information, but how do I know what information is good information? So the challenge for us is to live the kind of life where people come to know you as a reliable source, that you show the kind of character and commitment that by observing you, they can see that you're the real deal. And when they're trying to sort through these details of their life, there's a lot of different opinions out there, but you want to be the kind of person that everyone else could look to and trust to do something that's morally upright, Christ-centered, God-focused. You want to be someone who, when you are a sign pointing toward Jesus, they would actually take your advice, just like they did with John. When John saw Jesus and said, "You should stop following me and really focus more on this person, John had built up the credibility where they would do that. So he must increase and we must decrease. So my challenge for us this morning is just to reflect on ourselves and ask that question. Am I doing everything I can to make God's path into my heart as easy as possible? Am I really making myself available to God? Am I encouraging others on this same journey? And in all things, am I trying to be like a sign that points directly toward Jesus and says, follow him? Whatever good things I have, whatever good things I've learned, whatever character I've accomplished or grown in myself, it's all because of him. Turn to him. Look to him.